as part of the adaptation to living with a progressive neurodegenerative diseases, you let go of the future. You take each day as it unfolds. And so even though I was remarkably better walking around the neighborhood, I was still taking each day as it unfolded. And all of my physicians for 7 years had said, you've got secondary progressive MS. Functions once lost will never come back. So I didn't know what was happening. I just knew that day by day. But the day I rode my bike, I knew that the current understanding of MS was incomplete. So that really transformed how I thought about disease and health. It transformed the way I practiced medicine. And it would transform my mission in life and the way I conduct my research.
I'm Ben Grenell, part of the early startup team here at Levels. We're building tech that helps people to understand their metabolic health, and this is your front row seat to everything we do. This is a whole new level.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to A Whole New Level. This is Dr. Casey Means, co-founder and chief medical officer of Levels. I am so excited for today's conversation. Dr. Terry Walls needs no introduction, but I am so excited to do one because I have been a huge follower of her work for over 10 years, and it has had a profound impact on my life professionally and personally as one of the first entry points and first exposure into functional medicine for me. So I am incredibly grateful. Dr. Walls is a clinical professor of medicine at University of Iowa and also maintains a prolific research career. She's had over 60 peer-reviewed scientific abstracts, posters, and papers. And her personal story is incredible. She has experience as a patient being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis over 20 years ago, an autoimmune disease that left her in a wheelchair and on a path towards being bedridden. And she took her health into her own hands. She scoured the literature to understand if there were any possible treatments for MS and ultimately developed the Walls Protocol, which is a nutrition and lifestyle program to treat all chronic autoimmune diseases, which reversed her disease process, restored her health, and allowed her to get out of her wheelchair and back on her feet. Her learnings turned into an incredible book called The Walls Protocol, and she gave a TEDx talk that has over 3.5 million views on YouTube called Minding Your Mitochondria, which everyone should go out and watch after listening to this podcast. She's inspired countless individuals to make the choices to support their health and vitality, and I am so excited to welcome you, Dr. Walls, to the podcast and to dig in specifically to the relationship between blood sugar, metabolic health, and autoimmune disease. Welcome to A Whole New Level.
Hey, thank you so much, Dr. Means.
So for those who may not be familiar, can you define for people what an autoimmune disease is, a framework for thinking about this process in the body, and how autoimmune diseases may be similar from a root cause perspective?
Okay, so when I was in medical school a few years ago, we're taught that autoimmune diseases are the immune cells attacking self. We don't really know why. They, for reasons entirely unknown, must be genetic. At that point, we didn't even link infections. And all we had was prednisone. And then we started adding some other immune suppressing drugs. And understanding's gotten a little bit more sophisticated. But we appreciate that there are hundreds of genes that increase the risk. And there's still this long list of unknown environmental factors. And the conventional approach still focuses entirely on immune suppression. And of course, that's not the approach that I take, nor is it the approach that I teach. I focus on what are all the modifiable lifestyle factors that we can address. So we focus on creating health. And as a byproduct, you may discover that your chronic diseases begin to get under better control, and then begin to regress. I'm going to take you back to my health journey here for a little bit. You know, so 40 years ago, during medical school, I started having these electrical face pains, and they build over a period of the next 7 years. I had an episode of visual dimming. see a neurologist, can't explain that. Fortunately, they don't connect my face pain and visual dimming, because they could have diagnosed MS then. Fortunately for me, they did not. 13 years later, after I had my two kids, then I developed leg weakness. See the best people, take the newest drugs, and so within 3 years, I'm in a tilt-reclining wheelchair. And that's when I decided, like, you know what? It's pretty clear I'm going to become bedridden, demented, and the trajectory of my face pain is such that it's more frequent, more severe, far more difficult to turn off. I'm already on maximum dose of meds. I'm already going to the pain clinic. I've already gone to multiple pain centers. I am likely to have my face pain turned permanently on. And at that point, light sound triggers my pain. Speaking triggers my pain. Swallowing triggers my pain. And I'm taking high-dose solumedrol when these episodes turn on. So I'm like, okay, I've got young kids. I have to do everything that I possibly can. So I can still read. I went to PubMed and I started reading the basic science. You know, at first I was looking for drug development studies. Then I had this big aha, like, I can't get these drugs. So I switched over to start reading nutraceutical studies and started with a supplement cocktail. And so I created this supplement cocktail. And I was focusing in on cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease, ALS, because the nature of my disease had been a slow progression, looked much more like a progressive MS, even though I'd had two relapses in my entire, at that point, 27-year history of my disease. And it appeared to me that the root problem was mitochondria, that they couldn't make enough energy. So my supplement cocktail was focused on mitochondrial nutraceuticals. And after 6 months, I was no better. So I was pissed off and I stopped a little. And I couldn't get up, couldn't go to work. On the third day, my wife, Jackie, says, honey, why'd you take the supplements again? I mean, what's it going to hurt? So I take them. And the next day, I can get up and I can go to work. Now, mind you, I'm still struggling with fatigue, but I'm like, oh my God, that was really cool. So 2 weeks later, I do the same thing. I stop my supplements, wait 3 days, start them up the third day, and I can pop back up and go to work. Now, mind you, popping up is hardly popping that much, but I could at least go to work. And I was like, this was empowering. Like, oh my God, there is something to this. So now I am really excited about reading the literature. So every day I'm scanning and reading a paper or two after my family's gone to bed. And I'm still okay with thinking that I can get by with 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night, so I can spend my time reading. I realized that that was probably not a very smart thing to be doing. And, for years, I really focused on fixing my mitochondria with supplements. And so I get a gradually more complicated supplement cocktail. And I find IFM, take their course on functional medicine, have a little deeper understanding, add a longer list of supplements. And then a couple months later, I had this really big aha. Because I'd already switched from being a vegetarian to a paleo diet based on Lauren Cordain's work and his papers. But I had this idea, like, what if I took this long list of supplements and said, where are they in the food supply? And I got them from the food. So it was the first decision that I said, I'm going to focus on creating health. And so that was more research that I had to do. And the Linus Pauling Institute on Micronutrients was very helpful. They helped me identify the food sources. And so in the early days, I had these long list of foods that I was stressing on my diet. And this new focus started on December 26th. And within a month, I was not as exhausted. And my physical therapist said, Terry, you're getting stronger. And he began to advance my exercises. And within 3 months, I do this really radical thing. I get out of my wheelchair and I walk down the hall and mail a letter. And my colleagues are like, oh my God, Dr. Walls, you're walking. You're walking. And so, and that's stunning. And then, 3 months after that, well, actually maybe it was about 4 months after that, I decided I want to try bike riding again. And we have this emergency family meeting. It's on Mother's Day. And we decided that I can try riding my bike. My son's going to jog alongside on the left. My daughter Zeb's going to jog alongside on the right. And Jack's going to follow on her bike. And I push off, that wobbles a little bit, but I catch my balance and I'm biking and my kids are crying. Jackie's crying. I'm crying. If you look at my eyes closely, see, I'm crying, reliving that moment, because that's when I figured out. Because up until then, as part of the adaptation to living with a progressive neurodegenerative diseases, you let go of the future. You take each day as it unfolds. And so even though I was remarkably better walking around the neighborhood, I was still taking each day as it unfolded. And all of my physicians for 7 years had said, you've got secondary progressive MS, functions once lost will never come back. So I didn't know what was happening. I just knew that day by day. But the day I rode my bike, I knew that the current understanding of MS was incomplete and that who knew how much recovery might be possible. 4 months after that, I do an 18.5-mile bike ride with my family. Once again, we're all crying. You know, my kids are crying, my wife's crying, and I'm crying when I finish that bike ride. And so that really transformed how I thought about disease and health. It transformed the way I practice medicine, and it would transform my mission in life and the way I conduct my research.
I'm bowled over, and I am just so grateful to you for the work that you put in to dig deeper and to challenge the convention and go to some of the preclinical research, you know, the mouse research, and actually put together a whole new framework for thinking about health that was really based on systems biology and around giving the cells what they need to function properly.
This was all about thinking about the cells. Once I zeroed in on, okay, the mitochondria, I've got the nutrition right for the mitochondria. Of course, I was thinking supplements, what were all the supplement cocktails, which got complicated. And VemCourse was helpful. But still, nobody was talking about the microbiome yet because we didn't know about that. And it's sort of embarrassing now to realize how long it took me to think, okay, I have made some dietary changes that were important, but what if I structured, instead of thinking about what to avoid, what I should be eating, and I could use all these things that I said were important for mitochondria, figure out where they were, the food supply, and probably other really important molecules would come along as well. I want everyone to know that I did not get better from that supplement cocktail. You know, people have heard about my use of electrostimulation muscles. I did not recover. As much as I love E-Stim, I did not recover. The magic was when I shifted my thinking to creating health. Am I doing everything that I can? Have I maximized my nutrition using food to the very best that I possibly can? Have I gone back to meditation? And I had, so I redid that. And I was, I'd always stayed on the exercise bandwagon. So I continued to work very hard with my physical therapist. But it's the creation of health. When we focus on treating disease, we get it wrong. Even when we focus on those mouse model preclinical studies, we're still going to get those wrong because they're focused on understanding pathology, one molecular pathway, and health and life are deeply interconnected. All of that metabolic pathways are so richly interconnected with checks and balances that when we focus on pathology, we will not be able to correct health. But when we focus on health, on what are all the things that underpin health, and add them incremental by incremental step, that's when the magic happens for me. And that's when the magic happens and the patients I take care of.
I love that so much. And something that I think in a lot of ways you really got me started to think about, which now is the dominant way I view health and medicine, is that we have to focus on the cell. All health and disease comes from either cellular function or cellular dysfunction. This is the basic, one of the building blocks of our bodies. Obviously, there's the atomic level as well, but these are these beautiful machines that are working so hard, but they need specific things to function properly. And, you know, they need the avoidance of other things to function properly. And that's where that really beautiful relationship between food and the cell comes into play. Because like you said, supplements may have a few of these things that the cell needs, but food has thousands of chemicals that we don't even know about what some of these are that give this beautiful machine what it needs to generate health for us. And so I think a point that you make that is so important is that when we focus on real, whole, cleanly grown foods, we're fighting most of the battle here. We're getting those thousands and thousands of chemicals in plants that are going to do such good work for our cells.
And I believe that number is actually about 80,000 constituents.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's in plants. And then we, you know, go into the animal proteins and to the fungi as well. Then that number becomes even larger. If we think about our ancestral beginnings, whether we go back as Homo sapiens, you know, 250,000 years, or we diverged from the primates, 6 million years, or when we became mammals, 200 million years, when we were unicellular, which are now billions of years, we had this very long history of metabolic complexity. That means that the solutions aren't going to be a single molecule drug-based solution. We have to be able to honor that complexity of our biochemical pathways.
So what I'd love to pick your brain about here is focusing on the mitochondria. Your TED Talk is called Mining the Mitochondria. This clearly became something that came up in the research for you, showing that mitochondria and mitochondrial dysfunction may be a centralizing factor in many of the different diseases we're seeing. And mitochondria are really a core part of our metabolism. And so I'd love to hear this link between why mitochondrial dysfunction can then lead to the body attacking itself in autoimmune disease. What's that pathway between problems with our mitochondria, which, and unfortunately, Western modern lifestyle in many ways are hijacking the mitochondria and making them dysfunctional. And we can talk about some of the reasons for that. But then how that translates to being a feature that links all autoimmune diseases and the body then essentially turning on itself and creating immune response against the body.
You know, the way I might be incorrect here, but I see it more as an accelerant. That if your mitochondria cannot generate energy efficiently, then whatever disease processes you have will be accelerated.
So I think the mitochondrial dysfunction is really an accelerant. This is not enough energy that puts all of these tissues in strain, and it will accelerate the disease process. In addition, because of the cell danger response, we now know the mitochondria are deeply involved in recognizing cell danger, that when in the inner contents spill out into the extracellular space, those molecules, particularly ATP, are recognized by the cell membranes, and that activates the innate immune system. And then that will address the pathogen, the infection, or as in when I broke my wrist, the fracture, and cleans up the debris. The second step is the mitochondria involved in that second step. They'll call in the stem cells to do the repair work. And then the third step, which is reintegrating the repaired tissues back into the surrounding tissues so they can function normally and complete healing and resolve the inflammation. And the mitochondria is involved in all three of those steps. So it's both an accelerant and it's intimately involved in immune function and either accelerating immune function or failing to resolve the immune dysfunction. So it has dual roles. And it, I think, is a very big player in autoimmunity. But it's also a very big player in most of our non-infectious chronic disease states, whether it's a mental health problem, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease.
And you've done quite a bit of clinical research in the MS population and have looked at several biomarkers in your research of metabolic health in this population. And what do you see in your own data set in terms of rates of increased blood sugar or insulin resistance or metabolic dysfunction in a population with MS versus a non-autoimmune control population?
That's a very consistent finding across most autoimmune disease states, whether it's MS, lupus, RA, probably true for psoriasis, although I don't know that. I certainly predict that of the hundreds of autoimmune diseases, that they will probably have 1.5 to 2.5 times the rate of the general population of insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome.
What do you think is going on here in terms of the mechanisms, in terms of chicken and the egg? Is it that hyperglycemia induces mitochondrial dysfunction through increased reactive oxygen species, and then that leads to this dysfunction that may lead to immune reactivity? Or is there something else going on where maybe something else is causing mitochondrial dysfunction, and then that's leading to both metabolic disease and autoimmune disease? Or what's the model that we can think about this relationship?
We have wandered so far from our evolutionary roots. The diet we eat is so radically different. We eat continuously. We eat a lot of sugar. We eat a lot of fructose. We eat a lot of high glycemic index foods. We are continuously forcing the release of insulin. We have disrupted our microbiome. We are eating so many synthetic compounds in our diet, putting them on our skin. So all of those factors will drive insulin resistance. All of those factors increase our vulnerability to autoimmunity. All of those factors increase our vulnerability to serious mental health problems and chronic disease states. So I think the root cause is that we have terrible diets, we have toxic exposures, we have a lot of adverse childhood events and early trauma for our children, we have a lot of chronic stress as adults, and we don't have enough hormetic stress followed by sufficient recovery time.
That summary alone of all the different things that are impacting our core fundamental cellular biology from working, if we could just like print out that list and just focus on so many different aspects of our modern living that are ultimately feeding into this common denominator, which is mitochondrial dysfunction and poor cellular health. And while I feel like it can be overwhelming for people to think of all those things that need to be right, you know, it can almost seem hopeless. I think it's actually really an opportunity because there's so many different areas that you can focus on to do right by yourselves.
And what I want people to do is to start small. You know, when I talk about behavior change, I invite them to think about, you know, some aspect of their health behaviors that they could begin to improve. So we get curious. We're going to talk about diet. We're going to talk about meditation, exercise, sleep. And in some of my studies, we make you do everything all at once. And in some ways, that's easier. In my clinical practice, that's going to be a very kind conversation. Like, okay, so here are the domains. Where do you want to start? Let's come up with a goal that you're confident you can really do. Because I want you to have a change that you can actually do as opposed to a change that you only do 50%. And then we build on that success.
Such a wise approach, you know, giving people the manageable entry points to start and maybe start seeing that success and then using that as a way to really fuel and catalyze continued behavior change.
I used to insist that people, you know, do the Walls diet first. And I actually have become a little more mellow about that now, realizing that for some, they have to meditate first and get their stress down, more manageable, and then they can begin addressing food choices.
Well, shifting things into getting into some of the hard science here, because a lot of our listeners really love the mechanistic aspects. You and I had a conversation recently about a really interesting chemical mediator in the body called osteopontin. You've uncovered some really interesting work about how this chemical that is secreted in the adipose tissue, when it's high, can have really negative and toxic effects on the brain. And so this is sort of one of these links between metabolic disease, high levels of visceral fat and visceral adiposity, this cytokine, and then the neurodegeneration and neurologic disease. Can you describe for people what this relationship is and what we've learned about it?
So it's also involved in bone health. So it's an important compound there. We know that it is involved in immune regulation. And people who have rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus, MS, have been seen to have elevated levels of osteopontin. And then again, when I was at one of my MS research meetings, I was listening to researchers talk about osteopontin's effect on the microglia. And the microglia are the monitors of the brain environment. And depending if the microglia see the brain environment as hostile, they will begin attacking the invaders and killing brain cells and killing myelin and killing synapses and leading to rapid atrophy of the affected parts of the brain. Or the microglia can see, like, this is a great environment. Everything looks good. But I see a few strained synapses and parts of the brain that need nurturing support. So I'm going to go there, secrete all of these nurturing compounds, and I'll repair the myelin, I'll repair the synapses, and so microglia can be restorative or destructive. And what intrigued me was they were discussing how high osteopontin accelerates the microglia to be very destructive, which then got me into reading. And so this has been known for some time. This has been reproduced, that osteopontin can shift the microglia to be more destructive. And what drives high osteopontin? Insulin resistance, too much central obesity. And so I have a freezer full of specimens. And so we've been writing grants. We just submitted a grant to look at our freezer, and osteopontin was one of the biomarkers that we proposed to analyze. So I'll be able to tell you, hopefully, and funding cycle will run 3 years. It'll be 3 years before I'll know this answer, but hopefully in 3 to 4 years, we can have this conversation and we'll be able to tell you what we saw.
Very, very interesting. Osteopontin, I think, is a word that most people is not on their radar yet. And so it's really exciting to hear from you that this might be an area of, you know, of strong interest and also actionable interest, because
Absolutely. From
what it sounds like, if people can improve their insulin resistance, their central obesity, visceral adiposity, that you might be able to actually reduce your levels of osteopontin. Mm-hmm. And this could have then a downstream positive effect on our microglia.
Correct. And this might be one of the mechanisms how it's through the microglia that why high blood sugars accelerate cognitive decline in worsen Alzheimer's. It's probably through the microglia. That's part of the mechanism, would be my conjecture. And we'd have to have some experiments to investigate that, but it certainly seems plausible.
So another autoimmune disease that I think is of great interest to the people listening to this podcast is type 1 diabetes, because mostly we focus on type 2 diabetes in the spectrum of really acquired insulin resistance and hyperglycemia that comes from that. But of course, there's this whole other branch of type 1 diabetes that is autoimmune destruction of our pancreatic beta cells, which produce our insulin. So it's less an issue of insulin resistance and more an issue of not having enough insulin around. So I'm curious if this disease state also fits within the WALS protocol framework. And is there anything from the framework and what we know about mitochondrial dysfunction and microbiome effects on autoimmune propensity that can be applied to type 1 diabetes?
Yes. When we look at the dramatic uptick of autoimmunity since World War II, they talk about inflammatory bowel disease, MS, and type 1 diabetes, that there are environmental factors that are tied in probably to the change in the food supply, the dramatic increase of fructose, the dramatic increase of sugar processed foods, the increase of synthetic chemicals in our diet, and the dramatic shift in our microbiome because of all of the antibiotics. All of those are a factor in why those three autoimmune diseases have increased. So, yes. It's not just the infection that triggered the destruction of the pancreatic islet cells. It is the environment that set that cascade up. I'll also tell you that we've had certainly many, many patients with type 2 diabetes tell us that they've reversed their diabetes using the WALS protocol. But I've also had many people with type 1 diabetes tell me that they've had dramatic improvement of their blood sugars and their management of their disease using the Walls protocol. There was one lady who has a fairly remarkable story. She had pulmonary sarcoidosis in addition to type 1 diabetes and was in ICU because of her severe sarcoidosis on very high dose prednisone to control her sarcoid. And while she's in ICU, one of her neighbors hears my very first lecture that I gave here in Iowa City. And so the neighbor went to see Julie and her husband to say, when you get out of the hospital, we're going to cook for you, because I know how life is just so difficult. And the food they cooked was based on the principles that I laid out in that very first lecture, which looks very much like the principles that I teach in my TED Talk. And her sarcoidosis melted away, stunning her physicians. So she was able to get off her prednisone. Her insulin control became, you know, much, much better. Her renal disease had been very severe. She was on the brink of needing dialysis. And her renal function improved remarkably, was no longer an immediate threat for needing dialysis. And then I finally met her about 5 years after the fact at another conference. She told me that story. So part of why I'm sharing that whole story for you, Dr. Means, is that, and of course, I had no idea of the impact that I had for Julie, that you don't know the ripple effect of these podcasts, or do I know the ripple effect of that TED Talk or my books or the practitioners that I teach. But the work we are doing is transforming the lives of millions and millions of people. So I so appreciate that you're taking the time to do these podcasts. I appreciate that you had the brilliant insight to create Levels, to give people the tools to get their insulin resistance under better control. It will have this ripple effect of millions and millions of lives.
Well, thank you. And I think that is so powerful. I mean, like I mentioned in the beginning, the ripple effect of your work, even in my own life, has been profound. And I'm just so grateful to you and many of the authors in this space who have really put themselves out there by challenging the convention and digging deeper and asking the question why over and over and over again.
When I first started having these public conversations, let me tell you, the neurology community was very upset, severely condemned over and over again. Fortunately, I stuck with it. I kept doing my little research, getting our papers published, writing our grants. And I now have a joint appointment in neurology. And my neurology colleagues are co-investigators on my grants. And I just got comments today from the chief of neurology on my current proposal. And he's like, oh my gosh, Terry, this is very compelling, very exciting. And so I've come a long way in these 11 years from being condemned as, you know, intolerably dangerous, to being seen as having these really interesting, innovative ideas that now my very conventional chief of neurology, who is the chief of the MS clinic, thinks are brilliant and visionary.
Mm. It takes a lot of bravery to be one of those first voices.
You know, when I first started changing how I practice medicine, people were complaining. My chief of medicine, chief of staff at the VA called me in and had to explain myself. And then I had to go have the same conversation with the chief of medicine at the university, who said, Terry, you're going to lose your license because all we need is somebody to file a anonymous complaint. You'll get inspected. You'll be inspected by people who don't believe in functional medicine, integrative medicine. So you need to learn how to talk about this. So they sent me to work with the chief of the complementary alternative medicine clinic. And actually, I was very grateful that they did. So it became very clear with my patients and with the public that I'm focused on creating health. We're going to really focus on modifiable lifestyle factors, and we'll see what your body can do with that. I'll have to watch you closely for your blood pressure, your blood sugar, and your current medication use so you don't become over-medicated. But we're going to focus on creating health using these basic lifestyle principles. And when I shifted how I spoke to my patients that way and the residents, I quit getting complaints. And when I focused my clinical notes that way, I quit getting complaints. And my chief of staff and my chief of medicine said, "Atta girl, we appreciate that you're doing that. You're going to, that'll be fine. You'll be able to pass peer review because we need you to pass peer review, Terry." And so, you know, that's my caution when I train practitioners, is that we have to teach you how to talk about this, because you and I get so excited. It's so clear. Like, oh my God, this is treating and reversing so many disease states. But we have to be very careful that what we're doing is we're focused on creating health and monitoring current medication use and adjusting them so people aren't over-medicated. Because that language will feel very comfortable to our conventional colleagues and very respectful. As soon as I say, I'm treating MS with diet and lifestyle, that's not FDA approved, and that can be sanctioned, and that will not pass peer review. But if I say, I'm focused on creating health by treating diet and lifestyle, and we're going to watch your medications and adjust them so your blood pressure doesn't become too low, your blood sugar doesn't become too low, and then you can talk with your neurologist about what makes clinical sense to you. Everyone is very happy with that. You know, my neurologist colleagues are happy with that. My chief of medicine is happy with that. My chief of neurology is happy with that. And so we have to be careful that we teach our functional medicine practitioners how to talk about this in a way that respects conventional medicine, respects the patients, respects the healing process. Because what we're doing is we're creating health. And as a side effect, sometimes, not always, but sometimes you regress a considerable amount of pathology as a side effect of creating health.
Before we conclude, there's one question that I just is lingering in my mind that I really want to take an opportunity to ask you, which is something that I think other people might also wonder, which is, you know, we've got all these different autoimmune diseases that look very, very different, from type 1 diabetes to rheumatoid arthritis to lupus to MS. They all have very different clinical faces. And what you talk about in the book is that there's really just a handful of core physiologic features that have kind of gone awry that can lead to all of these things. How does that happen in the body, where in one person it might look like lupus, and one person it might look like rheumatoid arthritis, and another person it's MS? How do they show up with these different faces?
Isn't that really interesting? So we have disordered immune function. We have weakened mitochondria. We have toxin overload. We have hormone imbalance. We have difficulty eliminating our toxins. And I have different sets of microbes in my gut. And then I have different genetic vulnerability. And so depending on the microbes and my genes, when my immune system gets revved up and I begin making autoantibodies, that will begin clearing out that infectious problem or that food protein that I think is an infection. If that protein has a similar amino acid sequence to another structure in my body, in my brain, in my joints, in my lungs, in my skin, that part of my body is going to get damaged as I clear out that problem protein, whether it's an infection or a food protein. And my vulnerability is a reflection of my genetics and my microbiome and the foods. And the similar amino acid sequence between my structures and those various proteins. And then I'll add to that, and we could use myself as a case in point. So as a youngster, I have migraines. That's an early prodrome. I have really heavy periods. And I think that's just sort of a lot of women have miserable, heavy periods. And then when I decided I want to have kids, I discovered I have severe endometriosis and going through IVF. And by then, I've already had 10 years of my trigeminal neuralgia, which was the autoimmune process involving my brain. So I had an autoimmune process involving my brain. I have asthma, autoimmune process involving my lungs. I have an autoimmune process involving the endometriosis. And I have very mild psoriasis. If you don't address the root causes, you keep developing more autoantibodies, more autoimmune processes, and more parts of your body will become casualties in the autoimmune process development. So it's one of my messages to people is, Yeah, you may need disease-modifying drug treatment for your autoimmune disease that you have, but if you don't address the underlying root causes, you will continue to develop other autoimmune processes through this molecular mimicry, and you will pick up another body part casualty, whether it's asthma or psoriasis or endometriosis or autoimmune thyroid disease or Behçet's. And besides, you want to have healthy aging, healthy brain, and all that stuff. So everyone, whatever you got, whatever chronic complex health problems you have, you want to be sure that you're also doing everything you can step by step with your modifiable lifestyle factors.
Yeah. And you touched on something there that I think is also important in this metabolic health blood sugar conversation, which is the concept of warped proteins and that these can be a trigger for the body to fight. And I think I'd love for you to just touch on the relationship between glucose and warped proteins and glycation and how hyperglycemia might lead to some of this dysfunction in the structures of our body that then lead to the body being like, what is this?
I think we would be so far ahead in our healthy aging if we would all check our glucose and check for the possibility of insulin resistance. And, you know, ideally, I'd like to see because you can be skinny and have insulin resistance. You can be skinny, you can not have any central obesity, be thin on the outside and fat on the inside. And so if you have elevated blood sugars, you're going to be at risk for this glycation, the sugar being attached to the proteins and the proteins becoming oxidized, non-functional. And that will be an accelerant for this autoimmune process and can be an accelerant for that cell danger response. Mm-hmm. If you aren't looking for insulin resistance, you're going to miss the thin on the outside, fat on the inside, because we have so deranged our diets. We have such terrible diets for so long that I don't know what the number is, what the accurate percent would be that actually have insulin resistance. But it is probably far higher than the rate of obesity. I don't know, because I don't know that anyone has done any kind of population basis to really look for that number.
I would just love to see a big retrospective study looking at a large hospital system triglyceride to HDL ratio, which is something we already have cholesterol panels on everyone. And that would give us at least a hint at insulin sensitivity, which could be really interesting. So anyone listening, that might be
That's a good idea. I could mention that to my postdoc.
Literally every adult patient has that cholesterol panel. And it'd be fascinating to see like who's over one of a ratio, who's over two, who's over three. Does it correlate with BMI? Does it correlate with blood pressure? This would be fun to work on.
That could be a nice epi study for a large data set such as Women's Health Initiative. So,
well, to wrap up, just a sort of actionable takeaway, couple high yield things people can do to support their mitochondrial health through diet and lifestyle. What would be some of your top recommendations?
So, number one, ditch all the sugar sweetened beverages. Number two, ditch all the fructose. All of those paleo-friendly sugar substitutes that are all fructose, get rid of those. Number three, replace grain-based products with vegetables. Number four, I'm a tall lady, 6 foot tall, so it's pretty easy for me to have 9 cups of vegetables a day, 3 cups of green, 3 cups of sulfur, 3 cups of color, but I don't know how tall you are.
6 feet.
Okay, so we can still have our 9 cups, no problem. And then if you're a meat eater, you know, 6 to 12 ounces of meat. If you're not a meat eater, gluten-free grains and legumes for your protein.
Perfect. Well, I hope that this conversation is very uplifting for anyone listening who is on the spectrum of autoimmune disease. I think the key message that we're talking about is that, and that you've promoted in such a beautiful way over the last decade, is that there is so much hope. There is a lot that we can do, but we do have to change the choices that we're making every day. But these choices can be wonderful, like including more beautiful vegetables, and they work. Would you say that it's safe to say that focusing on improving metabolic health can be part of a journey in moving towards improvement of autoimmune disease. Like that is an area. Yeah.
Let me be even stronger. I think everybody with an autoimmune disease really should go investigate their metabolic health. I told everyone we should know your glucose, your insulin levels, your A1C, and answer that question, do you have developing insulin resistance? And if you do, then we need to have a strategy for dealing with that. So yes, if you have an autoimmune disease, I very strongly urge you to investigate, do you have insulin resistance?
Amazing. How can people find you, Dr. Walls, online?
Terry Walls, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, W-A-H-L-S .com. My Instagram handle is Dr. Terry Walls, and Facebook and Twitter is Terry Walls.
And I highly recommend following your Instagram because you often do a meal recap of what you're having for supper. And very frequently, it inspires me to have a slightly healthier dinner because I know what you're eating. So very much recommend that.
We will be recruiting for a new clinical trial in the very near future. This is for a dietary study comparing a modified paleo diet, a time-restricted olive oil ketogenic diet, and dietary guidelines diet. We'll follow folks for 2 years. We'll get MRIs at the baseline and at the end of the study. It will be one of the largest and longest dietary intervention studies that will have been done to date. So we are very excited about that. And the key is we need to have people with relapsing remitting MS who live within 500 miles of Iowa City. And we'll get the links so people can go look for that study and screen and look to see if they're eligible for any of the other studies that we are conducting.
Thank you so much for taking your time today to educate this audience, and really appreciate you being here, Dr. Walls.
Thank you.